What did she say? In 1992, I regularly went to visit a small place called Sørvær on Sørøya, in the most westerly part of Finnmark, which is a big county on the northeastern tip of Norway, bordering on the North Atlantic and the Gulf Stream. The utterance I'm going to discuss and the case I'm going to present to you comes from a trip late that autumn. It is a statement from a woman who had just lost her son. The job of going into what she said leads me in the end of this paper to bring in some reflections concerning Wittgenstein's Tractatus. I often wonder if I have understood at all what Wittgenstein is talking about in the Tractatus. But I think that the problem of understanding the lady at Sørvær is much of the same kind as the problem of understanding Wittgenstein. First, I will show you Sørvær on a map. It lies on a group of flattened rocks off the land. I usually went there by first taking a coastliner from Tromsø to Øksfjord, staying overnight in Øksfjord, then going by ferry over to Hasvik on Sørøya. You can also go by plane. If you see the third map, you will see the island out to the left. The distance from Hasvik to Sørvær is around 15 miles. After 1.5 hours by bus, one can look down on Sørvær, a place with approximately 300 inhabitants, but with a big production line for filleting cod and pollock. I have been asked by the Norwegian Research Council to write a report on the communication between people living on the coast and the county administrative centres in places like Alta in Finnmark. At that time, there was a crisis in the Norwegian cod fisheries, and the big question was, in reacting to this crisis, did the administration and the local people understand each other? Did they speak the same language? In the standard case of communication, the offices of administration used questionnaires that had to be filled in by the fishermen and their wives. Did these forms help to reveal the actual situation on the coast? Could they be used to tell the authorities what kind of action was to be taken? Or could the official language lie about the situation using the wrong categories for catching the coast people so established way of life? The next but last map is for the boatman. It is actually a very close view from above of Sørvær. And the last picture is for the tourist. They can see that the place is really afloat on the sea. It's like a boat, actually. In December 1992, the production line at Sørvær had been at a standstill for 10 months. People did not get up in the morning. School children did not get to school. In the local papers, or actually in the local paper, medical authorities spoke about a collective depression. the journalists registered that people stayed in behind their front doors. The most eloquent talked about a certain numbness, but did not much want to comment on their situation. In spite of all that, those who had their work at the fish factory, and that was around 80% of the population, never lost their hope that the production would start again in the beginning of the next year, and did not want to leave the place. They saw themselves as part of a crew working and living on the same boat. The traditional annual celebration that year, where absolutely all the inhabitants participated, was going to take place in the evening of December 14th, which was a Saturday. The celebration was planned in the spirit that things could not get any worse and that the factory soon would start up again. It was going to take place in an impressive building called the Samfunnshuset, which housed both cinema and a concert hall, in addition to an enormous kitchen. The whole complex had been financed and was owned by the local population, not by the owners of the fish factory. But things did get worse. On the morning of the 14th December, people noticed a big rescue helicopter that started circling when the morning light came. Soon everybody knew that a local fishing boat had gone down and that one of their own, a local fisherman called Jan Helge Bakkeby, had drowned. Situation that was about to change for the better had now taken another turn to the worse. Several decisions had to be taken. Was it going to be a celebration the same evening? Should they throw away the food? Traditionally, that was the right thing to do when shipwreck led to loss of life in these coastal societies. Actually, it was done again on the eastern part of the island just a couple of years ago in a similar situation. One cannot celebrate when a member of the local society dies in that way. During the day, 14th, the lady in chief for the arrangement in the Samfunnshuset that evening contacted the uncle of the deceased and presented him with the problem. They needed him to contact the family to get the final answers so they could know better what to do. The uncle first went to see the wife of the deceased, but she would not take any decision. He went back to the Samfunnshuset. In this situation, it gradually became clear only the mother of the deceased could take the decision. And the uncle went to see the mother. And when the mother of the drowned fisherman was asked, should they call off the celebration in the Samfunnshuset, she said, no. No, she said, let us have the celebration. The uncle started to argue, people want to show respect for the deceased and his family, and even if it's no easy thing to do, it is up to you to say the right thing, and nobody else can say it. Then came the remarkable statement, let us have the celebration. Jan Helge, as everybody knows, was born on the very same day the Samfunnshuset was opened and inaugurated. The truly remarkable thing is that she is making a connection between the oncoming celebration that evening and the celebration on the day of Jan Helge's birth, thereby making the beginning and the end of his life meet in the celebration. The uncle, a bit uneasy, went back and reported to the ladies at the Samfunnshuset. And there was a long discussion by the ladies in the committee. They were testing out the statement for implications and trying to grasp its meaning. Could this mean disrespect for the deceased? The ladies in the committee asked themselves another question too. Could they take the risk of the mother being able to go through with it? Would she stand up to it in her behavior now and in the future and not break down? Lack of firmness from her side would mean true disaster. She was herself the widow of one of the big fishermen at Sørvær, and after his death she had been losing touch. Was she determined and tough enough to stand for a decision the following evening, the next day, and the day after that? At last, the important ladies in the committee did accept that the celebration was going to take place. And soon the whole place knew what the mother had said. And in the evening of the same day that Ann Helge died, people went to the celebration in the Samfunnshuset with the mother in the lead. The ladies in the committee reluctantly accepted that the mother was taking him back from the sea, using the means at her disposal. They only hoped that she was able to stand firm and go through with it. Some, however, found the whole thing too odd and did not want to participate. But most of the local people who knew Jan Helge did go to the Samfunnshuset that evening. Afterwards, many of them have reflected on what they did together that evening. A death is turned into a celebration. What kind of celebration was that? One whose aunt went to the Samfunnshuset that evening told me later that his aunt had said when she returned from the celebration that evening, asked if the atmosphere was not one of disrespect towards the deceased. She said that it was a great feast and the general atmosphere was a mix of silence and humor. But that day changed the whole public atmosphere at the place. Normal life was again made attractive like it was 1 year before. What did the mother mean? To turn death into a celebration is a Greek discipline, an old European sport. If we go to the dialogues like the Phaedrus and the Symposium, the paradoxical insistence to read the death of the body as a celebration of the freedom of the soul is a philosophical combination of Socrates dialoguing to find out who he is. Socrates celebrated his own death. But what is the link between death and celebration at Sørvær? The discussion around the mother's celebration statement has never stopped on the island. But is it now much clearer? Perhaps not. But new perspectives are still coming up. But it has always been a serious strain in this discussion, a tone that makes it philosophical. Last September, I was invited to discuss the statement on a place where it was first uttered, on a seminar held on Sørøya by the health administration in Finnmark. More than 50 persons, most of them health workers and women working in the local health administration, both in Alta and on the island, participated. On the seminar, one could, after some time, distinguish three conflicting interpretations of the mother's statement. I remember the discussion of these points in the seminar as cool and intense, with little place for emotions. The discussion lasted for more than 4 hours, from 8 to 12 o'clock in the morning, with only a short break. People were really hungry for discussion. The first position was the one taken by the Alta administration. The statement is impossible for us to understand and categorize. This position was real enough, but not very clear, especially when it came to be precise about phrases like "we don't understand." The administration in Alta, after 13 years, still treats the statement from the standpoint of a superior culture. That was the basic attitude pressed about their justification for their position, they argued that if one goes to a dictionary to look up the meaning, the word death and the word celebration don't go together. Clearly, the people from the administration did not much want to reopen an old case. Neither did they want much to use their imagination to reconstruct how the mother thought. They said that they saw not one context, but a total chaos at Sørvær. And they added even, there is a limit to what we can accept. An Icelandic priest participating in the seminar came up with a suggestion. According to him, the mother meant that the inauguration in the Samfundshuset that day nearly 40 years ago was also a celebration of the birth of her newborn son. If that was a link, the priest said, then Jan Helge was given a name by that inauguration ceremony. Then he could see a point in the mother's agreeing to a feast now that her son was dead, since the name was free and could be given to another person. But the people from Alta would not listen to this. To accept that such a wild statement can play a part in people's lives takes time to stomach, they said, and did not realize that they perhaps were speaking the truth. The second interpretation takes us from distinctions concerning culture into psychology. The psychologists on the seminar, almost without exception, reacted to the mother's statement by focusing on Jan Helge's birth. The statement that came out of the mother's mouth, they argued, reflects the fact that she could never really forget that the birth of her firstborn was on the opening day of the most impressive building in the community. According to them, the statement was meaningful, but only understood as an expression or a psychological reaction by the mother. Two important happenings collided on that day of her life. First, the day her first son was born, therefore became associated with the day of the inauguration of the Samfundshuset. It was only natural that under pressure she would connect the two events and see the one as leading to the other. Another psychologist said that the point of the mother's statements was maybe an act of setting the concerns of the problem-ridden small society at Sørvær before the concern for herself and her family. They saw in her behavior a modest person who would not let her own family stand in the way for a public celebration. That is, the statement functioned as her excuse for letting the local feast everybody on the place deserved go as planned. A nurse in the social team suggested that the mother was giving something away, something to the community by her action. But she also added, I do not know what. And a problem, the mother's statement was to everybody at the seminar, but perhaps not so much to the Alta people. Of course, if language is regarded as a system where every word already have a given semantic meaning that one has to follow up in every statement one utters, then as this statement clearly present a problem of a special sort. But most people will recognize that if one wants the mother's statement to make sense, one has to see its sense as dependent on the situation in which it was used. And what we count as the situation here cannot be limited to privileged selections from Alta. It must also include the actual situation at Sørvær. The third interpretation goes like this. The statement is a superb example of how a person manages to get hold of herself by integrating a catastrophe into the totality of her world. This last interpretation is the most rewarding. To cope with crisis is part of everyday life in server. One might see the mother's launching of her statement as an example of good crisis management in a community where crisis management is not the exception, but the rule. The death of Jan Helge not only was the last accident in a series of disasters, but also the disaster that could be used to define the general situation and bring up the deep frustration located beneath the surface. From this point of view, I think we can see the mother of Jan Helge is using her own tragic situation to make the server people meet together that evening to share the bottomless sense of loss and hopelessness they had all been suffering from for nearly 1 year, thereby turning the private event into a public one. Surprisingly, many speakers at the seminar interpreted the mother's statement in this direction. So the mother invited the people of Sørvær to celebrate on that day when Jan Helge died. Someone said it was more like a message to the living to stick together in their difficult situation than it was an invitation to hold a wake for her dead son. The mother is going public with the fact that the opening celebration of the Samfunnshuset occurred on the day of Jan Helge's birth. But an unexpected change of focus from a private to a public context, she is linking different things, namely Jan Helge's death and the planned but now problematic feast at the Samfunnshuset, together in a new local totality. Seen from this point of view, there is nothing heroic about the mother's behavior. She is staring at the world of Saffelhalte and trying to see it for what it is. She is not trying to act courageously, and she is not confronting anybody's interests. Her ethical attitude is rather like one of seeing, not of doing. By using the oncoming celebration as a link, like moving through a door which unexpectedly has got its hinges on the side where the lock should be, the mother invites the server people to participate in her sorrow, and she invites them to do the same thing as herself, to see beyond the present situation in spite of everything that has happened that day and during the last few months. By means of the mother's contribution, Jan Helge's own life is rearranged. By letting time run through the place's history, his life becomes the dynamic center in her version of how things stand. Running back in time, Jan Helge's birth is seen as part of the inauguration day of the main community building. But back into the present, the now extended identity of the day of birth points to the oncoming feast as the culmination of his life. If one wants to ride on the surf of meaning that from now on will be seen as carrying him in his last fight with the sea, one must participate in the oncoming feast. If we regard her statement or interpret it in a similar direction, her statement offers everybody living at the place to emigrate into her version of the totality in order to cross the borders of their private isolation and transform the situation both for Jan Helge's family and for themselves. This is not a show of responsibility, it is more like a challenge where the challenger is taking a risk. But I don't mean to say that he is doing anything unwise and or unethical. Her determination shows that she is crossing a border. Only by holding nothing back can she convince them that she is making up for her sense of loss. She is back to a place where there is no distance to the world. And only if they follow her in the trail of her short string of words, can she know that she did succeed. Still, it is the extension of her son's life by means of a single, half-forgotten fact. That is sufficient to give her statement a convincing ethical meaning. The whole sense of the world was changed by means of one single suffering. This way of reading the mother's action has a special attraction for me, since I went to Sørvær to study people's ability to cope not with death, but with globalization. For me, the mother's action out there on the rim is not an event relevant to certain specially interested anthropologists only. This small place instead functions as a suitable scene for the study of what can be called the positive effect of the breakdown of meaning. There is a reason for this. The close electronic and economic connections to the market in a globalized fish industry makes every change in the prices in the world market felt locally on a day-to-day basis. In seconds, something that happens far away can attack your most cherished beliefs about living in a friendly and reliable world. What is it with the reaction to the hard-blowing winds of globalization that is relevant to the study of language and ethics? My suggestion is the following. When your life is made into an economic ruin, you sometimes can be brought to see yourself as recovering from life in a substitute reality that is out of touch with your true self-interest. Let us take a look around. Globalization is much more than its tsunami effect. In addition to the economic aspect, globalization also stands for a cultural change in local society where it is blowing in. Ordinary language does not much register that enormous change. For ordinary language, Sørvær is much the same, even if it is turned into a small part of a global market that suddenly takes you more than 200 years ahead of yesterday. The aftershakes of the destructive forces of globalization makes every person's language destabilized, but only from the inside. This destruction, where the soft part of the personality is left with little ground to stand on, can only be repaired by giving the world new borders. To study globalization as a cultural change is not only to study the local shock and loss of self-protection, but also to see how the local society extends its borders and locally seeks to establish for itself a new global meaning. When she was hit, Jan Helge's mother had to turn the situation around by concentrating closely on the objects that were part of the new and devastating happenings. She had to start from scratch, according to a newfound sensibility for the local situation and getting to her feet again. Actually, she was constructing a new limited totality by changing the form of a fact by means of a half-forgotten Sachverhalt, by connecting it to the present situation as its true context. She was setting down new border stones and giving the celebration a meaning. Such things do not reflect a painless process. Nobody can say that the mother, when speaking about her loss, is using words without giving them sense and reference. Nevertheless, a new sense of reality is produced, but only by rearranging the form of things. Thus, the whole sense was changed by means of the rearrangement of one single Sachverhalt. The mother's willingness to give herself up strikes me not as weakness, but as a strength to accept life without conditions. It is a willingness to take back the meaning of life independently of what happens. This attitude, which reminds me of Wittgenstein's Tractatus, can in her case be seen as a product of a merciless self-confrontation to change her own situation. But I can find no better use of the case of the server lady than to see it as an illustration of some basic ideas in Wittgenstein's Tractatus. Maybe we need the examples coming from a personal diary, from a notebook, so to speak, in order to present a fully resolute view of what the Tractatus is about. My point is that what Wittgenstein in the Tractatus calls ethics is something that can be experienced in the real by the people of such a small society, and to some extent even said. According to Tractatus 643, ethics concerns an exercise of the will that does not alter the facts, but makes the world become an altogether different world by altering its limits. Well, in the world of Sörvall, this is so because the mother's action transforms the whole situation. She does not alter the facts, but shows everybody how to look into the situation, not as a closed book, but as an open situation they can all share, thereby she makes the world a different world by altering its limits. Wittgenstein's statement in 643 further presents the ethical exercise as an effort that makes the world wax and wane as a whole. Only if we don't look for the ethical in a separate reality beyond the limits of the world, but insist on taking notice of transformations in the world of facts, can we come to see how the waxing and waning that Wittgenstein speaks about relates to our actual experience and have the ethical significance that he implies. Since this concept plays an important part in Wittgenstein's view of ethics, let us turn to the well-known drawing in the Tractatus 5.6.31 to study how the notion of limit functions seen from close on in a relevant context. The drawing is reproduced on the first of the three maps that I have handed out. The drawing consists of two small tear-like circles, one small, one big. Small closed within one end of the bigger. It is, from what Wittgenstein says in the text, obviously meant to elucidate that even if the self presented by the small circle as a fact is not in the world, as illustrated by the big circle, like the eye is not included in its visual field, the self is not included in its world. It is the limit, the grenze of the world. Note that when the subject here is presented as grenze, the word is translated as limit. When grenze here is interpreted in English as limit, one is looking at the grenze as a far horizon. Picturing the world from a central viewpoint, presupposing that the world, or the nation for that matter, has only one center. This centralized perspective on the world is a method to be used in Wittgenstein's experiment with his writing of the book The World as I Found It in paragraph 5.6.31. It is a perspective that organizes all empirical statements about the world according to the central point of view, and consistently with this becomes a method of isolating subject. This procedure does not lead us into the ethical. But notice that in 6.43, where Wittgenstein goes on to draw some ethical conclusions, the meaning of the word Grenze is changed. Quote, if the good or bad exercise of the will does alter the world, it can only alter the limits of the world, not the facts, not that which can be expressed by means of language. In short, the effect must be that it becomes an altogether different world. It must, so to speak, wax and wane as a whole. The world of the happy man is a different one from that of the unhappy man. Here, a grenze is no longer simply a line of separation, something you can look at from afar, but a line that connects you to what you previously were separated from. A grenze is no longer a limit that separates, but a border that opens for an extended contact with a totality you are already participating in. This change of meaning in the word grenze is important. Only if the limit is made into a border can we think of the world as a reality that wanes and wanes, and present the subject as a grenze of the world. If we look back now, the history from Sørvær makes us see the truth of this change. The talk of the world as a whole that can wax and wane fits the world of experience as I found it on Sørvær. But now the limit of the world that can wax and wane is no longer a fixed and far horizon seen from the center. The limit of a waxing and waning world is now a border that one can move up to and move with, changing one's situation. In the Tractatus, Grenze can be translated both as border and as limit. Grenze in this double sense not only shows the centralized subject in the world of facts, but also how a speaker in the world can feel it wax and wane as a whole, due to the transformation of a single sufferer. This means that the drawing in 5, 6, 3, 3, 1 also can be read as an illustration of how the ethical subject is dependent on its world. And the ethical existence of the subject requires that the subject finds some fact in the world to hang on to, if it is to experience anything at all. Read in this way, we can see how the drawing turns the transcendental showing into a more existential one. The waxing and waning as a whole, as a local center, demonstrating the earth-bound aspect of subjectivity. If we think of the experience as it starts in the small circle, say something terrible happens that drives you out of the circle. Your own world is no longer able to provide meaning. The Tractatus wants to make you taste the the reality of being left in a situation where your daily world has broken into pieces. If you think of the drawing like this, we are brought into a situation where we will try desperately by fleeing from the tough experience, and trying to use all sorts of ladders to step outside our world of experience for something to trust. The old center of life is destroyed. The ordinary doing seems without life. And one is trying, again with a feeling of hopelessness, and Osea to find a new center outside the world of facts. But the entrance to the ethical perspective does not lie in that direction. The entrance to the ethical perspective goes through a particular fact in the actual world. The transformation comes up just by seeing a change in the facts that drives you mad. The big circle then brings you back to the facts of your own life, sensing a new totality due to the change of one important fact. The ethical experience, according to Wittgenstein, is not an abstract Kantian experience that there is nothing ethical in the world of facts, because ethics is transcendental. It is the sometimes rather devastating subjective experience of personal change in and through a singular fact in the world. The border, as we know, can see it, is a border of transformation of the empirical world. The experience of limitation is the experience of the transformation of the Grenze of the world from limit to border. Limitation in this double sense will mean that there is an ethical world in excess to what can be said. You can now see the drawing as a demonstration or a concept of showing, and different from the so-called transcendental showing discussed in connection with propositions about logical form, in that the drawing invites the engaged reader to celebrate a transformation of himself in the world. No surprise then that the wax and wane can take us from death to celebration in one movement. Let us sum up by again bringing in the mother at Sørvær. By bringing her in, we will see the drawing of the two circles come alive, giving us a clue as to how we should understand Wittgenstein's ethics. And the people of Sørvær are living together in a common but problematic world, are placed in the small circle. Then comes the shipwreck. As a result, the order and meaningfulness of the small place breaks down. They are confronted by a cosmos too big for them to control. They are wanting to take refuge outside the social world, and as a result may become divided from reality. To save the situation, the mother, by means of her statement, are collecting the people at server into the big circle and inviting them all to do some association and substitution to acknowledge a simple suffering. When the mother says, Alf Helge is born on the same day the Samfunnshuset was inaugurated, the small circle around his life is then extended into the big circle that surrounds all of them who can follow the mother's gaze. They respond by following her gaze. In the small circle, centered on Jan Helge, we can now see the dawning of a new and bigger circle that sets a new common border for their lives at server, with the Samfunnshuset as the new center. The lady at server presents the big circle as a threshold location where substitution and association defines a new totality with more than one space and time. In this cold place, the pillars buried in the depth of their local world brings to the surface a framework that nevertheless establishes a universal order. At least there can be there can be no doubt that the people of Server shared an impossible emotion of carrying each other's burden that evening at the feast in Samfunnshuset, even if not much about it was said. The mystery here is the transformation from fact to whole, even the fusion of the two, felt as the healing of one's self. Such an ethics is surrounded by silence, not doctrine. And on that evening of the big feast at Server, a silence accompanied the mother's statement from the moment she uttered it. This silence was not just a lack of words. The participants, for a great deal, kept their mouths shut and were silent about what they saw. But their eyes were feasting. They were, for the moment, no longer victims of an unhappy destiny, but could nourish themselves from something nobody could take from them. Yeah, thank you.